Okay. So, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. Okay. So, welcome to the April 2010 Charm Telecon, and we're fortunate to be have a speaker today, Dr. Christophe Sautin, and he is...
Excuse me, this is the conference coordinator. I'd like to remind all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time.
Thank you. I guess I'll start my intro again. This is the April 2010 Charm Telecon, and our speaker today is Dr. Christophe Sautin. And Christophe is a VIMS team member. So VIMS is a Cassini Instrument Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. I think I have that right. Christophe might sound French, but he's actually Californian. He's been here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory since 2007. And before that, he was at the University of Nantes in France. So he's involved with Cassini, and in particular in planning the Titan science observations and working on Titan science and other science pertaining to internal structure and dynamics of planets and their moons, and has been involved in a number of missions, including Cassini, Mars Express, Venus Express. He's got quite a lengthy pedigree. And he's going to talk to us today. The title of his talk is Titan, the Moon That Would Be a Planet, which is the title of an article that appeared in Scientific American. I recommended that people read it. It was in the March 2010 issue, along with Ralph Lorenz, who was a co-author. And the talk is subtitled Carbon Cycle, Geology, and Dynamics. And with that, welcome, Christophe.
Well, thank you very much, Marcia. And, well, actually, you know, as I told Marcia, it took me some time to put together these slides because every time you want to speak about Titan, you want to include some of the latest results that we have obtained with the Cassini mission. And sometimes I cannot include everything because not everything has been released. So, for example, some of the last images we have obtained with VIMS during the last flyby are not included into that talk, but it's just great. And, you know, Titan is a place where you see, you always see something different happening. So it's really a great place to study. So the title of my talk actually was found by the journalist of the Scientific American. You know, I think it makes a lot of sense because, as I will show in the introduction, Titan can be compared to moons, but can also be compared to planets like the Earth or Mars. And so Titan is a very special moon because Titan is the only satellite in the solar system with a dense atmosphere and also with liquids at its surface. And just because of this two features, Titan is very, very interesting in terms of studying processes which involve both the interior and the atmosphere. For my talk, I will do an introduction, then I will speak a little bit about the observations by the Cassini-Huygens. I had to choose among those observations. Then I will describe what we mean by the carbon cycle. I will mainly describe what's going on in the atmosphere and on the surface. And then I will end up this carbon cycle saying that in order to understand why we have so much methane in the atmosphere, then we need to understand the dynamics and the interior structure of Titan. So that's why there is surface morphology and geological implications, and then a few slides about the interior structure and the internal dynamics. I took a lot of information in a book which was released at the end of 2009. Actually, I think people could find it only in 2010. It's a book written by a number of people involved on Cassini, and the editors are Bob Brown, who is a VIMS PI, and Jean-Pierre Le Breton, who was Huygens project scientist, and Hunter Witt. And this book has more than 500 pages, and you have several chapters, and it's every every information that were obtained by the different instruments on board the Cassini and Huygens during the prime mission. So it's entitled Titan from Cassini Huygens, but you know, a lot of information in that book. Okay, so now on the right side, I just put three views of Titan. On the top, you have Titan just after Voyager. It was an orange ball because we couldn't see the surface due to the very dense atmosphere, the aerosols in the atmosphere, and the presence of methane, which absorbs a lot of the light. And then in the middle, you have what we can see with the infrared spectrometer. So we can see much more of Titan's surface, and we can identify geological units, and we can look and try to understand what's going on Titan's surface. And at the bottom, you have one model of the interior structure, and I guess that's what we know the least right now. It's what is the interior structure of Titan. Okay, so if we go to slide number two, so it's slide number two is Titan before the Cassini-Huygens mission. What we knew at that time was the mass, the radius. In 2000, and I think that was a major discovery, in 2000 we got a map of Titan at 2 micron. This was an Earth-based observation, so this is a map on the lower left of the slide. You can see red where you have high values for the reflected light at 2 micron, and blue when you have a low value. And actually what is red is what is called Xanadu, what is known as Xanadu on Titan. And what it showed in 2000 is that actually we can observe Titan's surface in the infrared. Remember that the Cassini spacecraft was launched in 1997, and at that time we did not foresee observations in the infrared by the VIMS instrument. So actually, it was very good news for us that that the Meyer showed that we can see Titan in the infrared. Other information is eccentricity, and this is very very important in order to understand Titan's history, because Titan has a very high eccentricity. I put the value on the right, in the table on the right. It's 2.9%. And we don't Titan has no, there is no big satellites to maintain this eccentricity. You know, in the Jovian system, you have Io, Europa, and Ganymede. And there is a resonance between the orbits of these three satellites, and so you can maintain an eccentricity. But in the case of Titan, Titan is the only big satellite of Saturn. And so the eccentricity should be done by tidal dissipation in Titan, and in 4 billion years, so during the, you know, the evolution of Titan, this eccentricity should get to zero. So what it means is that apparently very little dissipation occurs in Titan, which has implication about the temperature and the interior structure of Titan. There are some models we can explain that, and I will explain that at the end of the talk. So we knew the mass, we knew the radius, the density also, and because the density is 1.88, then it's a density between ice and silicates, and so we think that Titan is made of ice and silicates, about 50-50% for both of them. And then I put the last number at the bottom of the table on the right. It's 800 gigawatt, and this is an estimate of how much power is available due to the decay of the radiogenic elements contained in the silicates. So to compare, we compare that with the Earth or Mars later on, but on Earth, you have about 40 terawatt. So it's about 40 times more power available inside the Earth than for Titan. Okay, so now we go on slide number. On slide number three. Okay, so the slide number three shows the comparison between Titan, Mars, and the Earth. So if we take the mass and the diameter of the Earth to be one. So you can see that on the left panel. Then the diameter of Mars is 0.5. The diameter of Titan is 0.4. So you can see that the size of Titan and Mars are very similar. For the mass, it's quite different. The mass of Mars is one-tenth of the mass of the Earth, and the mass of Titan, because there is so much water, is 1/45 of the mass of the Earth. But when you look at the atmosphere on the Earth's surface, you have a pressure of 1 bar, and the atmosphere is made of nitrogen and dioxygen. On Mars, the pressure is very low. It's only 7 millibar. And on Titan, you have a pressure of 1.5 bar. And I guess everyone knows about these numbers. But they are very important for, you know, to try to understand why Titan has such a dense atmosphere. The surface temperature are very different, too. On the Earth, you are just above the triple point of water. On Mars, you are at minus 60 degrees, and on Titan, the temperature is minus 170 degrees, which is actually just above the triple point of methane. The density goes from 5.5 for the Earth, 3.94 for Mars, and 1.88 for Titan. And the composition, the Earth is mainly silicates. Also, we can see we can see water on the surface of the Earth. So the water is only 0.01% of the total mass of the Earth. It's 10 to minus 4, the mass of the Earth. And on Mars, so it's mostly silicates, and on Titan, we think that there are ices and silicates. Okay, so now we go on the next slide, which is entitled Titan compared to the Galilean icy satellites. So it's also interesting to compare Titan to Ganymede and Callisto. On the right, you have the four Galilean satellites. Io, which has no ice, no water, it's just silicates. Then you have Europa, which is the smallest one. Then is Ganymede, and the last one is Callisto. And Titan has a radius which is just in between the radius of Ganymede and the radius of Callisto. So Ganymede is a little bit larger than Titan, and Callisto is a little bit smaller than Titan. And for the mass, it's the same. Titan is just in between Ganymede and Callisto. What we know from the Galileo mission is that Ganymede is very much differentiated. We think that Ganymede has a liquid iron core because Ganymede is the only satellite that we know with an intrinsic magnetic field, which means that we need to have some liquid iron which can produce this magnetic field. And we know also that there is an internal ocean which explains the induced magnetic field. So this was a major discovery of the Galileo mission, that Ganymede is very differentiated and also has these two liquid layers, one in the very center and the other one closer to the surface. And for Callisto, well, we think that Callisto is partly undifferentiated. This is based on gravity data. But we know from the induced magnetic field that there must be also an internal ocean, which must be between maybe 150 kilometers to 50 kilometers deep. So this is a comparison. This is what, you know, the information we had before we started getting data from Cassini. Yeah. So the next slide, it's Titan compared to the Galilean icy satellites, and it shows some models of the interior structure of Europa, Callisto, Ganymede, and Titan. So Titan is still this orange ball, and we don't know exactly what the interior is made of. But if we look at Ganymede, for example, and you have a 2D plot of Ganymede on the left, from the center to the surface, you have a liquid iron core, which is dark on the left panel. Then you have a silicate mantle, which is dark gray. And then you have the water, the H2O layers. And you have three layers. You have the high-pressure layer, Then you have the ocean, and then you have the ice one, which is a low pressure phase of ice from about 100 kilometers to the surface. And what we think is that within this ice one layer, heat is transferred by convection, and that's why you can see maybe the two arrows that I drew on this plot, one showing upwellings and the other one showing downwellings. And when there is convection, it doesn't mean that you see surface features associated with convection. On Earth, we know that convection is a cause of plate tectonics, but on other planets, you can have convection and don't see almost anything at the surface. For example, on Mars, we think that there is convection in the mantle, but we don't see manifestations of these convection patterns on the surface. So we think that on Ganymede, we do have convection in the ice layer, but above the convective ice, you have a conductive layer, which is very thick and which isolates the convective layer from the surface. Okay, so this is the model we have for Ganymede, and it's very tempting to use this model for Titan, because Ganymede and Titan have about the same mass and have about the same radius. But when we found Callisto to be partly undifferentiated, then we have a big mystery. You know, why is Ganymede so much differentiated? Why Callisto is not? There are some models which have been developed more recently that explain that. On the right, you have the lower right. You have the same kind of model, but for Europa. And because Europa has much less H2O, much less ice than the others, actually the liquid layer is in contact with the silicates, and that's why Europa is very exciting in terms of exobiologic investigations. It's because the water is in contact with the silicates, and we have conditions which are very close to the conditions on the ocean seafloor. So Europa is very particular compared to Ganymede, Callisto, and Titan. Now the explanation for the liquid ocean is shown in the phase diagram of water ice in between the two drawings of Ganymede and Europa. So the vertical axis is temperature. It goes from 200 to 300 Kelvin. And the horizontal axis is pressure. And it goes from from 0 to 1 GPa. 1 GPa is 10 kilobar. What you observe, ice is very particular because the melting temperature of ice decreases with pressure. You can see the number 1, you can see the thick curve, dark curve, and you can see that this curve has a negative slope. It starts at about 273 Kelvin at zero pressure, and you can see that after that the temperature decreases with increasing pressure, which means that the ice, the solid, is less dense than the liquid, which is very particular to ice. And so if you imagine thermal gradients in the ice, which are the thin lines, you have two dashed lines which show different temperature profiles, you can see that the temperature goes from 100 Kelvin at the surface, so it's not plotted on this figure, but it starts at 100 degrees, and then it increases with a gradient of the order of 5 degrees per kilometer, and it crosses what we call the liquidus of ice. And this is the reason why you have water which is squeezed in between two layers of ice. So you get the liquid, and then in the liquid, heat is transferred by convection. It's the temperature profile is almost isothermal, so it means the temperature is almost constant. And because the high pressure phases of ice have normal behavior, then the melting temperature of this high pressure phases of ice increases with temperature, the melting temperature increases with pressure, and so you cross once again this curve, and then you get the layer of high pressure ice. So you have this layer which is squeezed in between this liquid layer which is squeezed in between the two solid layers. And on your offer, the pressure is much less than 0.5 GPa, and so you stay in the liquid layer, and you have contact of the liquid with the silicate mantle. Okay, so this is the comparison between Titan and the Galilean satellite. And now I will go to the Huygens and Cassini results. But maybe there are some questions for this introduction.
Any questions out there for Christoph? Sounds like not.
Okay.
Go ahead, Christoph. Thank you.
Oh, the Huygens probe descended into I have it wrong. So the slide is the Huygens probe. It's 2005, not 2004. So sorry about that. It was in January 2005 that the probe descended into Titan's atmosphere. And on the right, I put two artistic views of Titan. You know, things we imagine about Titan before we got the data. On the upper right, you have the probe. You can see a rainy day on Titan with a lot of clouds and lightning. Well, actually, we haven't seen any of those. We haven't seen rain on Titan, and I will show you that actually there are very few clouds on Titan. And on the lower right picture, you have a liquid Titan. That was another N-member model. Some models thought or described Titan as being covered by hydrocarbon seas. And so, well, with the data, we were able to show that we don't have a global ocean over Titan, but we do have big lakes, very large lakes on Titan. And on the left, you have the view which has been assembled by the Huygens team and which shows where the Huygens probe landed. So it's at the intersection of the two white lines that the probe landed. And you can see this this landscape, which when you see it, it's not very exciting. But when we get closer to the surface of Titan, we saw some very exciting things. So this is what Huygens observed when it landed into Titan. And as I will show later on, the observations by Huygens have been very important in order to understand the geology and the processes on Titan. So the next slide, which is entitled Constraints from the Atmospheric Composition. Yes? No? Okay. I thought there was one question. Okay, so constraints from the atmospheric composition. Actually, the atmosphere provides a lot of information about this. And the first thing we know is that methane, CH4, has a very short lifetime. It's on the order of 10 to 100 million years. And this has been measured with the escape rate of H2. Because methane, if you take two molecules of methane, it transforms into ethane and H2, and H2 escapes. So if you measure the escape rate of H2, then you get an idea of how much methane is lost by this reaction, how much methane is transformed into ethane. The value we have for the lifetime of methane in Titan's atmosphere is on the order of 30 million years. Then the second observation is that there is a gradient in methane. We have a concentration on the order of 1.7% at very high altitude, and close to the surface we get a value of 5%. So it seems that this gradient implies processes in the atmosphere. The third thing which is very important is the presence of argon-40. So argon is a noble gas. Argon-40 is formed by the decay of potassium-40. I mean, when potassium-40 decays, it gives calcium and argon. So argon is one of the products of potassium-40. And potassium is in the silicates. So the fact that we have argon-40 in the atmosphere implies that there is some exchange between the silicates and the atmosphere, because argon has to come out from the silicates. So it seems that there are some processes which involve transfer of mass and transfer of gas between the interior and the atmosphere. And on Earth, we know that kind of process. It's through volcanism that you can release the argon-40, which is in the silicates. You can release that into the atmosphere. The other observation is that there is very little argon-36, which is an isotope, and so the small amount of argon-36 actually is a very strong indication for the history of escape rates on Titan. And this goes to the next bullet, which is the isotopic ratio of nitrogen 15 to nitrogen 14. It's a little bit higher than the terrestrial value. I think it's 1.5 times the terrestrial value. So it seems if you take that with the fact that argon-36 is not present, it seems to imply that the nitrogen comes from ammonia and that the nitrogen does not come from the planetesimals which form Titan. So the nitrogen, because of this value of the isotopic ratio, the nitrogen is has escaped, which explains why there is more heavy nitrogen than light nitrogen. And so nitrogen has been, the atmosphere of Titan was formed very early in Titan's history. That's why I mean by primordial. But the nitrogen doesn't come from nitrogen in the comets or whatever small bodies from Titan, but the nitrogen has been formed by the transformation of ammonia. But this is a model, and if you read the paper by Jonathan Runyon in this book I mentioned, he is very cautious about the formation of nitrogen by the photolysis of ammonia, although he says that this is the most likely process that we can think of right now. And then the other bullet I put, and I couldn't put everything, but what we know, and that has been a discovery of the Cassini mission, is that very heavy organic molecules are being synthesized in the upper atmosphere, very high in the atmosphere, at altitudes on the order of several hundred kilometers up to 1,000 kilometers. And this was a surprise because we thought that the very heavy organic molecules were produced at much lower altitudes in Titan. Okay, now we can go to the next slide, which is a nice view of the carbon cycle on Titan, which is mainly related to methane. So if we start with methane being in the lakes, so the methane can evaporate. Then you get some methane in the atmosphere. In the atmosphere, the temperature gradient is such that cloud can form at about 20 kilometers. You can see on the altitude is the vertical axis on the left. So you have methane cloud at this altitude. Also, what we know is that methane is transformed into ethane. Clouds of ethane would form at higher altitude. You can see the clouds of ethane at about 50 kilometers altitude. Then you can see some haze, which is produced by the reaction, the organic reaction in the atmosphere. So some big molecules, and we think that these molecules can be several microns in size. And then these molecules and these organic molecules would fall on Titan's surface, and they would form the organic dunes that you see on the right side of this image. So there is a cycle in the a carbon cycle going from methane to organic dunes, and what we have to understand is the numbers that we have for the different concentrations of methane, ethane, and hydrogen, and the concentration of haze in the aerosol layers. So if we go on the next slide, another important parameter is the surface temperature. So this is a result of the CIRS instrument on board Cassini. What you have is what we call the brightness temperature versus latitude. Minus 90 is the South Pole and plus 90 is the North Pole. During the prime mission, Cassini observed Titan when it was the summer for the South Hemisphere, so it was winter in the Northern Hemisphere. So the South Pole is a little bit has a little bit higher temperature than the North Pole. You can see a value. So the mean value is the blue points, a value on the order of 91.5 Kelvin on the South Pole, and it's 90.5 Kelvin on the North Pole. So it's not a big difference. You know, it's 1 degree difference, but it seems to, when you look at the uncertainty, it seems to show a real difference between the two poles. And you can see that at the equator, the temperature is 94 Kelvin, so you have a difference of 3 degrees between the poles and the equator. And the very small difference is due to the fact that the atmosphere is very dense. But the important point is that this temperature, this high temperature, high, I mean, it's not that high, but it's high for the Saturn system, is due to the greenhouse effect caused by methane. Without methane, the temperature would be 70 Kelvin, and we will see the implications of such a low temperature if Titan had no more methane in its atmosphere. Now we go on the next slide, the clouds. And there are clouds on Titan, but compared to Earth, we don't have a lot of clouds. So on the left, you have the Earth with a cloud that can be observed from space. And you can see that at mid-latitude over Africa, for example, it's very much covered by clouds. And on the right, you have one view of Titan in the infrared, and you can see the yellow streaks, and these are clouds. And this was one of the days on Titan where we observed a lot of clouds. There are observations of Titan where we don't see any cloud in the atmosphere. So this one was one with a lot of clouds. And on the upper right picture, I show the north, what we call the North Polar Hood, which is composed of clouds of ethane, based on some simulation and interpretation of infrared spectra. And well, we have some good explanation for the formation of this cloud. And we have the cloud on the North Pole. We don't have it on the South Pole. And what we expect, and we will see that during the extended mission, is that we are going from winter to summer in the Northern Hemisphere. So this polar hood should disappear. The clouds should disappear, and they should form on the South Pole. So that's something we are looking for with the extension of the Cassini mission. So not a lot of clouds compared to Earth, and we have ethane clouds on the North Pole, and we have methane clouds at the mid latitudes. So the I forgot to say that the yellow streaks we see on Titan are at latitudes on the order of 40 degrees. So if we go to the next slide, which shows the cloud coverage versus time, so the vertical axis is latitude. We go from South Pole minus 90 to North Pole plus 90. And we have observations with the Cassini mission from June 2004 until, so we went up to January this year. So each vertical blue line is one Titan flyby. And when you see blue dots, it represents the latitude at which we observe clouds. Other points are Earth-based observations. So that's the diamonds, black diamonds by Rowe et al. You have the red diamonds by Emily Scheller et al. You have green and blue and other observation, Earth-based observation. And something which is really interesting to note is that in February. In March 2008, you can see the label February 21st, 2008. Just after that, you can see a lot of yellow or orange diamonds, and these were Earth-based observations of a very big cloud event on Titan. And it turns out that with Cassini, we saw Titan a little bit before and a little bit after, and actually we missed this big burst of clouds on Titan. So it shows that Earth-based observations are very complementary to the Cassini observation. We still observe, you know, a lot of clouds when you look at the points, the blue points, just after the observation, the Earth-based observation. But we didn't see as much as we would have seen if we had been able to observe Titan at this time.
Christoph,
so what, yes?
can I interrupt and ask a question? So all the diamonds are Earth-based observations,
yes.
Is that
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Diamonds.
And then the thick blue line shows the range of latitudes over which you observed clouds at a Titan flyby, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks.
And so you can see that most of these observations are the North Polar Cloud, you know, above 50 degrees. And then you can see the South Mid-Latitude Clouds between 30 degrees and 60 or 65 degrees. Another thing is that models have predicted that we should observe clouds at the equator. And so far, there is only one observation, which is late May 2009, during which we observed clouds at the equator. You can see this thick blue line, which is just, you know, a sum of blue dots just across the equator. Okay, so this shows the cloud coverage, and as I said before, actually, there are not that many clouds on Titan compared to Earth. Next slide. It's a comparison between methane on Titan and water on Earth. So it's just to put some physics into the explanation. I'm going to explain the upper plot. So what you have on the vertical axis is pressure. So the pressure goes from low value at the top, 0.001 MPa. MPa is 10 to the 6 Pascal. And at the bottom, it's 1,000 MPa. I did that because, of course, in the atmosphere, you have low pressure, and in the interior, you have high pressure. And so the thick, dark line shows the pressure at the surface. You know, you can see a thick horizontal line, and above this line you have atmosphere, and below this line is the interior. So now you have the pressure. The horizontal axis is temperature. The surface temperature I put 94 Kelvin, and what you observe is that the point at the surface is within the stability of the liquid phase of methane. So this is a phase diagram of methane. The triple point, so where you have the three lines coming together, actually you may see only two lines and they intersect, and you can see that this point where you can have liquid, gas, and solid at the same pressure and temperature, this point is located in the atmosphere. And then the other important point is that if you imagine or if you simulate a temperature gradient within Titan, so I have two temperature gradients, which are represented by the dotted lines, 3 Kelvin per kilometer and 5 Kelvin per kilometer. And you can see that this temperature gradient stay within the stability field of liquid methane. Now, if you compare that with the situation for water on Earth, so this is a plot just under this one at the bottom of the slide. You have the pressure. So this is for the Earth. So the temperature are different. We go from 200 Kelvin to 600 Kelvin. The green line shows the temperature range on the Earth's surface. And it shows also the pressure at the Earth's surface. So it's 10 to the 5th Pascal, 1 bar. And the red line is the temperature profile within the Earth. So as it is the case for methane on Titan, you can see that for water on Earth, the surface temperature and pressure is in the stability field of liquid water. And if you increase, if you go deeper in the Earth, so that's the red line, you stay within the stability field of liquid water. So, of course, on the North Pole on Earth and South Pole on Earth, the temperature is much lower. So, in fact, this point is not at 300 Kelvin. This point would be at 250 Kelvin, for example. So, we can see the ice. But the temperature gradient would be such that very quickly we get into the stability field of water, liquid water. So there is some kind of similarity between methane on Titan and water on Earth. But there is one big difference that we are still investigating the implications. So if you go back now to the plot on top of this slide, you see another line which is on the right side, and it shows on the right it's written ice plus CH4 gas. And under this line, it's written ice plus CH4 class rate. Actually, methane can be trapped into the water ice and form class rate. And the stability of class rate is actually much wider than the stability of solid methane. And so what it means is that if you have liquid methane in water ice, like it is suggested by this kind of plot, actually it's going to form what we call a class rate, and the class rate will be solid and very stable. And so the actually liquid methane cannot come out out of the ice crust unless methane is more abundant than what the ice can handle. I mean, you can trap one molecule of methane if you have six molecules of water, of H2O. So this is a big difference. Although on Earth you can say, well, if there is not much water, then the water can be incorporated into the silicates, and you get something which is similar to the class rate on Titan. So maybe there are more similarities that we think of right now. So now we can go on the next slide, which is a summary of the similarities and differences between methane and H2O, methane on Titan and H2O on Earth. So the first is that the triple point of methane on Titan is in the pressure-temperature domain of the atmosphere, of Titan's atmosphere, and this is the same thing for water on Earth. Methane on Titan, like water on Earth, evaporates at the surface, condenses in the atmosphere, it rains, and then the methane runs at the surface and would fill topographic depressions. This is the same thing for water on Earth. And the methane, like water, is a very effective greenhouse gas. But there are differences. One very important is that methane transforms into ethane, and so you need to have some reservoir of methane somewhere on Titan. Then if there is no replenishment, then the methane would disappear, the greenhouse effect would vanish, the surface temperature would drop, and nitrogen would freeze. And this would happen in less than 100 million years, likely 30 million years, and Titan would become like Triton. So we need to have a source of methane, and now we go to the geology part of the talk in order to try to get some information about what the source of methane can be. So are there any questions?
I've got a couple questions, but I think I'm going to save them till the end.
Okay.
So go ahead, Christoph.
Okay, so next slide, geology radar observations. So what the radar has been put on Cassini because it can see through the clouds. So it's not a problem for radar to see the surface. I will just describe a few of these slides. So you have Titan in the center, and I just extracted a few slides from radar, a few radar images. On the left, you can see some white areas which form some kind of linear structures. And the radar team interpreted these features as being tectonic features. Of course, one of the major discoveries has been the dune fields. Then if you keep going at the bottom of the slide, you can see a circular feature, which may be an impact crater. Then you have a much nicer circular feature, which is interpreted as an impact crater. On the right, you see some flow-like feature, whether these flow-like feature are cryovolcanic feature or are equivalent to mudslides on Earth. Other processes are being debated at present time. We observe a big crater, Menvar crater. There is a structure which people are still trying to find which process could have formed that structure, which is Ganesa macula. And we observe, radar observed a lot of small lakes and larger lakes like Kraken Mare or Ligia. Okay, we go to the next slide, which is infrared observations. So actually, with the infrared mapping spectrometer, we can observe Titan in seven infrared windows. I just listed the wavelengths at which we can observe Titan's surface. And one of the best one is at 2 micron, because at 2 micron you still have a lot of light which has been diffracted by the atmosphere or by the aerosols. But a lot of this light is reflected by the surface and it is analyzed by the spectrometer. So we are trying to find the characteristics of the surface based on the differences we can observe with beams at these different wavelengths. You can see on the lower right plot, you can see two spectra. And if you look at 2 micron, you can see a red spectrum and a dark spectrum. And you can see the difference between the bright plateau and the dark planes. So the dark planes would be in this kind of brownish area that we see on Titan, the equatorial region of Titan. And the bright plateau are the white areas that we see also on this equatorial region. And you can see that the difference between the two is very small, and this is due to the fact that most of the signal is due to the atmosphere. It's not due to the surface. So in order to analyze the surface, we need to remove the atmosphere, and it's a very complex task to do. And so, a lot of teams are working on that in order to be able to retrieve the real albedo of the surface from the infrared spectra that we have. But we can work with those spectra in order to determine, to characterize some of the geological units on Titan. And something that has been found, and I won't go into the details, but for example, the brownish color that you see on Titan map is very well correlated with the dune fields that has been found by the radar team. So when you put together the radar images and the infrared images, you find a one-to-one correlation, which is just striking. So there is very good there is information. We still need to get to understand what this information means in terms of composition, which is very, very difficult to achieve. So if we go to the next slide, just an example of an impact crater. Something we can say about the composition of Titan is that the surface is not made of water ice. And there are two data sets which tell us that it's not water ice at the surface. The first one is the infrared information. I won't go into the detail, but it shows that we don't have the spectral characteristics of water ice. One of the spectral characteristics, by the way, is that it absorbs at 2 micron, and it's clearly not the case on Titan's surface. And the other data set is a dielectric constant, which is on the lower left of this plot. When you have blue, it's very low value. When you have yellow, it's higher values. So you have a value of 2 for the dielectric constant, and the value for water ice is more like 3.2, 3.3. Yeah. So we know that the Titan surface is not made of water ice, based on these two data sets. On the other hand, if you have higher values of the dietary constant like 2, then you can say that you have a mixture of molecules which show an enrichment in water ice. And in infrared, water ice would be indicated by dark blue units, and you can see that on the right, you can see this dark blue unit just southeast of an impact crater. So this was a study by Stéphane Lemolik and others, and also Larry Soderblom on another area did the same kind of observations. And so we think that there are places on Titan where there is more water ice than others. So they would be more recent in terms of the geology because they have not been covered by all the organics. It's also very important to look at the radar data, which show how the dunes are covering these areas. After getting all this information, we need to now to look at the processes between the different geological units that we observe on Titan. So the next slide is a mountain range I discussed before. I showed the radar image, which is at the bottom of this slide. If you look at the upper left corner of the slide, we also observe linear features with the VIMS, so with the infrared images. Actually, at the beginning, we thought it was clouds, but we observed those features at different flybys, so now we know that they are real linear features, and we're trying to understand what do they mean in terms of the geology of this area. So we go on the next slide, which is the bright 5-micron areas. It's a very controversial, I would say. There have been a few papers showing these very bright areas. You can see on the right a Titan globe where you observe two bright areas south of Xanadu. These areas are called Tui Regio and Hoti Regio. And on the left, you have a higher resolution a map of Tui Regio. So it's very bright at 5 micron, and also you have some kind of lobate features which have been observed by radar exactly at the same on the same areas. And so it's a good candidate for a cryovolcanic site, even if it's not active at present time. It may have been active in the past, but flow features can be due to mudslides, so there are other scientists who think that this may not be cryovolcanic features, but just features related to mudslide. But it's very difficult if you think of something similar to mudslide to explain the very bright 5-micron feature. Okay, so now we go on the next slide, which is entitled cryovolcanic features with a question mark. Actually, if you click a second time, you will see the infrared information on top of the radar information. So if you come back, I'm trying to do that on my on my screen. Okay. So if you come back, you see on the right the radar observation, and Rosalie Lopez interpreted the bright area that you see in this radar image as being due to a volcanic vent located in the lower left corner of this radar image. So now if you put the infrared image on top of that, you see the yellow line which shows, so on the left, lower left of this yellow line, you would have the cryovolcanic feature interpreted by the radar team, and then these yellow lines underline the flow features. And so we had one observation at high resolution with infrared spectrometer, and you can see that when we crossed these blue lines, then the signal was much brighter. So it means that there is something, maybe it's, you know, a cryovolcanic flow, which a different porosity with different physical properties, which may explain both the radar signal and the infrared signal. So this is one area, but we haven't seen, you know, that many of this kind of bright features on Titan. So apparently it's very limited to a few areas. And one question we have is how long does it take to erode or to alter, you know, those kind of areas. So the next slide, which is the location of the landing site, I'm going to go fast on this one just because time is flying. So this slide shows a mosaic of the area where Huygens landed. Actually, Huygens landed in the image, which is on the lower right of this mosaic. So if you go to the next slide, you can see the comparison between an infrared image on the right obtained by VIMS, so on Cassini, and the Huygens image which was obtained. And then if you go on the next slide, you will see that if you overlay the Huygens image on top of the VIMS image, infrared image, then you have a very good correlation between the two images, which shows that the optical properties that we observe with the VIMS are really optical properties of the surface and are not optical properties of the atmosphere. Actually, it allows us to put some constraints on the rotation rate, the spin rate of Titan, because we observe the Huygens landing site about 4 years after Huygens landed on Titan. Okay, so the next slide is a comparison, and actually I put together this slide just to show how spatial resolution is very important. If you look at Titan at a resolution of 1 kilometer per pixel, which is the DISR, I mean the Huygens image on the upper left and the infrared image on the right, then you don't see the channel that you do observe with a resolution of a few tens of meters per pixel. You can see the river channels in the medium panel. So with Cassini, we cannot get that resolution. We cannot get 20 meters per pixel. The radar images have a resolution of 350 meters per pixel at best, and you need at least 2 pixels, so it's kind of 700 meters per, you know, resolution that you have with the radar. And with the infrared, when we have closest approach, that's pretty much what we have, 1 kilometer per pixel. So it's important to get better resolution, and better resolution means more information for understanding the processes that happen on Titan. So the next slide shows also a comparison between radar and infrared, and you can see that in radar for the Huygens landing site, you don't see much of the variation that we observed when Huygens landed on Titan. So it tells us something about the physical properties of the surface, and we are still investigating what does it mean in terms of the physical properties. You can see, for example, the radar images do not show any of the river channels that were observed by Huygens. And on the bottom of this image, you have the infrared image on top of the radar image to show where is the Huygens landing site. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, which is conclusions about geology, I think right now we don't have any convincing evidence for active cryovolcanoes. If there are questions about that, I will answer those questions. Because on Titan, actually, it would be much more difficult to observe active areas than it is on Enceladus, for example, because of Titan's atmosphere. On the other hand, what we know is that the number of impact craters is small. If you compare Titan's surface to the surface of even Enceladus or the surface of Iapetus, it's obvious that the number of impact craters is much smaller, which means that Titan's surface is young. But what does it mean? Is young 100 million years? Is young 3 billion years? It's something that we don't know at present time. We do observe mountains. Xanadu is an area which is about 1 kilometer higher than the surrounding plains. We also observe some linear features, which may be mountain ranges. And as I said before, spatial resolution is very important. So in the next slide, I have a few slides about interior structure, and then one slide about model simulating global evolution of Titan. So are there questions now, or should I keep going?
Yes, I have a question.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering, my name is Lynn from the Netherlands. I was wondering how much effect the thick atmosphere might have had on the impact craters compared to some of the other moons that have less atmosphere, or is that not significant?
Yeah, so a study by Ralph Lorenz, and there were also other studies by Jonathan Lenin, suggests that you have a cutoff at about 20 or maybe 10 kilometers. So it means that, you know, every crater which would be which would have a diameter less than 20 kilometers would not show up on Titan, because the atmosphere would have destroyed the impactors. But everything which is bigger should not impact too much the number of impact craters.
Okay, thanks.
That's for an atmosphere of 1.5 bars. Of course, if the atmosphere becomes what was denser in the past, so maybe this cutoff goes to larger values. Okay. Any other question? Okay, so we go back to interior structure. So I have described that before, so I won't go into the details. You have different end members for the interior structure. The Ganymede one would be the upper right interior structure, where you have iron core. And other models include just a silicate mantle and ice, like the model in the lower left corner. So two questions. How much is Titan fully differentiated? And is there an ocean between the two layers of ice? So we go to the next slide, the high-pressure ice layer. Well, what we know is that it has to be transferred through the high-pressure ice layer. And what we know also are some of the properties of these high-pressure ices. So these are kind of internal structure we are thinking of for Titan. But maybe the data that we are collecting will tell us something different. So we go to the next one, the gravity data. So actually there have been so far 4 flybys which have been devoted to a gravity study. So these flybys are T11, T22, 33, and 45. The data show two things which are important. The first one is that Titan is in hydrostatic equilibrium. This is important for the interpretation of the gravity data. So it means that all the topography on Titan is actually has been relaxed, and we have so we don't have a strong correlation between topography and gravity. But we have to keep in mind that the resolution we have on the gravity data is not very very high. I mean, we can go up to a degree 3 coefficients, as I wrote them on this slide. So Titan is in hydrostatic equilibrium, and we have to go up to degree 3 in order to explain the gravity field of these 4 flybys. And when you look at the data, it shows that Titan is partly differentiated. It means that the differentiation is more than on Callisto, but it's less than on Ganymede. And the paper came out just recently in Science by a team led by IS. And there is, further studies which have been presented at different conferences. But papers are not yet out to give models of the interior structure. So if we go to the next slide, It shows the density of the green layer you can see on the right versus what we call the Love number. Just to make it simple, if you have a Love number of 1.5, it means that it is undifferentiated. If you have a Love number of 0.75, like on the left, it means that it is fully differentiated, like Ganymede. Well, for Titan, the value that we come out with the gravity data is a value around 1. And around 1, you find that the density should be 2.5, 2.6. And 2.5, 2.6 is the density of silicate, which is called serpentinite, which is a hydrated silicate. So it's possible that Titan mantle would be made of this hydrated silicate, which is quite interesting. But you can, I mean, this only data cannot provide a unique solution for the interior structure. So you can imagine other interior structures where Titan would be much less differentiated than Ganymede. So we go to the next slide. I mean, other information. It would be really nice to have the induced magnetic field, but it's very difficult on Titan because, first, Saturn's magnetic field is much weaker than the Jovian magnetic field. Second, the Cassini flybys have to be at very high altitude because of the atmosphere, so we cannot fly at 300 kilometers or 400 kilometers as we did on Ganymede. We have to fly at 1,500 kilometers. And because the magnetic field varies as the distance to -3, it means that if we are at, three times higher altitude, it means that the induced magnetic field would be on the order of 10 times smaller. And also, Titan has an ionosphere, and the ionosphere provides a very strong signal, which does not exist on Ganymede, and so it's very difficult to interpret magnetic variations if we can observe those magnetic variations. There was a study by the radar team that Titan is on non-synchronous rotation, so this has been revised by the radar team, and so the new value of Titan's spin rate is much closer to synchronous rotation. So we cannot use a non-synchronous rotation to say that there is an ocean, but the fact that it's synchronous does not mean that there is no ocean. There was an electric signal which was detected by the Huygens probe, and actually this electric signal suggests that there is a conductive layer at 45 kilometer depth, and this could be the liquid layer. If you have an ammonia-rich ocean, then it's very conductive, and the electric data by Huygens would suggest that the ice crust would be only 45 kilometers thick. And also, the strong value of the eccentricity suggests that the crust is very cold, no tidal dissipation, and so it favors an ammonia-rich ocean because the ammonia decreases the melting point of ice, and the crust could be very cold, and so the crust would not dissipate a lot of heat by tidal dissipation between Saturn and Titan. Okay, I am almost finished. I won't go into the magnetic data, the case of Ganymede. The heat sources, so that's the next slide. Heat sources at present time. I already spoke about radionic heating, 800 gigawatts. I just show a plot which indicates the amount of tidal heating versus the viscosity of ice. As I said before, on Europa, you can have a lot of tidal heating. The red line, by the way, the red line would be the radionic heating, the 800 gigawatts. So you can see that on Europa, you can have two orders of magnitude more tidal heating than radiogenic heating. On Titan, it would be on the same order of magnitude, but we think that it cannot be the case because Titan has still a very strong eccentricity. And then there is latent heat, which is kind of heat which has been acquired during the accretion and which is being released, which is an additional source of internal heating on Titan. So the next slide shows a model of the internal dynamics, which was published by Gabriel Tobi a few years ago. And this model is still used by, still referenced by a lot of studies. And the main point of this model is just to explain that there were three times on Titan during which methane has been released in the atmosphere. You can see that in the upper plot. So the time goes from 0 to 4.5 billion years. So on the right would be present time. So at the beginning, you have the accretion, where you have a lot of methane could have been released in the atmosphere. And then the planet cools down. The planet, it's not a planet, it's a satellite. So the satellite differentiates. And then at 2 billion years, 2 GA, you have a new episode which is related to the onset of convection in the silicate mantle. So you have more heat coming out, and it destabilizes the methane in the crust. So you have another episode of methane released into the atmosphere. And then it stabilizes during another 1.5 billion years. And the last episode is related to convection in the ice crust. While there have not been other models published so far which give better explanations for what we observe, actually this model gives pretty good explanation of what we observe in the atmosphere. And since we don't know much about the interior structure, this model is still being used pretty widely. So the next slide is the last slide, conclusions. On Titan, we can observe a very rich diversity of processes. Of course, there is a formation of rivers, lakes, and dunes. Mountains have been formed, and so the processes responsible for the formation of this mountain are still to be found. There are outgassing processes because we need to explain the atmospheric composition of Titan. The carbon cycle implies that there are internal sources of methane in order to explain why Titan is still very hot, surface temperature of 94 Kelvin, and why there is still methane in the atmosphere. But we're still lacking convincing evidence for cryovolcanic features. The Cassini mission will start the extended mission, which is called the Cassini solstice mission, in a couple of months from now. And so we will get a better coverage by both radar and optical observations, so both the infrared observation and the radar observation. We will observe seasonal variations, and especially seasonal variations on the lakes, but also seasonal variations for the clouds. Other clouds are going to migrate from the North Pole to the South Pole. Well, actually, they are not going to migrate, but they are going to form now on the South Pole. And other clouds at southern latitudes going to vanish, and are we going to observe clouds at equatorial regions? And we will be acquiring more gravity and magnetic data. And for future missions, what will be very important is to get the topography, because with the Cassini mission, we cannot get the topography. And it's very important to have the topography information for geological analysis. It would be really nice to put some seismometers, because if Titan is active, seismology is going to tell us that it is active. If it is active, then we have seismic waves that will tell us what the interior structure of Titan looks like. Okay, and I will finish with that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Christoph. That was wonderful. Very interesting. So are there questions for our speaker out there in telecom land? Speak up. Going back to the earlier part, Christoph, with the atmospheric observations, was there any speculation about what the big burst of clouds was from the ground-based observations, or do you know the one that Cassini kind of missed?
Yeah, well, actually, Cassini observed one after, a year after. We observed another big burst of on time. And we don't want to speculate on what it can be. The atmospheric models have a very hard time to explain a big burst of clouds. How can you produce, a big cloudy day on Titan?
Right.
And so we are working with people who do global circulation models in order to see if there is any explanation. Because one explanation is that you get a lot of methane released from the surface or evaporation, and then you get formation of clouds at 40 kilometers altitude. But you need the methane to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the source of methane? That's the big question.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, we haven't actually we saw the clouds, but we didn't observe this area with high resolution, neither with radar nor with VIMS. And so we are trying to get high resolution observation of this area during the extended mission.
Right.
But we know that clouds. Everyone heard about the big, the Icelandic volcano,
yes.
Where you have a lot of dust coming out in the atmosphere, and then you don't see anything. I mean, that was a big, big, big outburst on Titan as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to say that it's a volcanic activity because we don't have any proof of that.
Has anyone published on that observation of you or anybody else?
No. We have that. I mean, the observation was, I'm trying to remember now. It was May last year. So it was May 2009 where we observed this very big burst. We thought that it could be a dust storm on Titan, but the winds which have been measured so far are not very strong. So why do you get strong winds on Titan? I mean, the temperature variations are very small. We should publish these observations, but we haven't yet.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Any questions that anyone's come up with out there?
I have one. Christoph, could you talk a little about the thinking on astrobiological potential as regards local heat sources, either from impacts or any potential cryovolcanic heating?
Actually, there is a conference this week, and people are going to speak about astrobiology on Titan. I mean, there are different places on Titan which are interesting. First, you have a lot of organic molecules. Just looking at what kind of organics are formed on Titan is very interesting. But the organic molecules don't have, the one we have observed so far, they don't have oxygen. So we are looking for places on Titan where you can get oxygenated reactions in order to form, I am not a specialist, but in order to form proteins and other interesting molecules for astrobiology. Yeah. And the places we think of are the lakes, because the lakes, the bottom of the lakes must be in contact with water ice. So there are places where the hydrocarbons could react with water ice. And of course, if you have an impact on Titan, then the temperature increases so much that you have liquid water. So liquid water is going to cool down very quickly on Titan's surface. We just have a paper published last month, I think, showing that actually in one day on Titan, because of the atmosphere, you cool down a liquid layer or hot layer by 50 degrees in just one day. Yeah. So it's very fast. But the interior, I mean, below, it's like, a lava tube. You have the crust on top, and then the lava, the interior is still liquid. So on Titan, that would be the same. So you could have liquid H2O, which would last several hundreds of years below the crust. It depends on how much has been melted during the impact. So this is another place. And of course, the third place is if there is a liquid ocean within Titan, then there are models which simulated evolution of Titan, and they came to the idea that maybe in this ocean you could have the organic molecules produced in the atmosphere that would migrate downward towards this ocean, and then you have organic molecules and you have the water, and then everything can happen. Did I answer the question?
I think you did. That sounded like Mary Beth who asked the question, right, Mary Beth? Maybe something happened to her, but yeah, that was a good answer.
The mute button was playing with me. Yeah, that answered my question. Thank you.
Any other questions for Christoph?
Yeah, I had one more question on page 30.
Okay.
If you could explain why non-synchronous rotation for a moon like Titan would be a better indication for an ocean than a synchronous rotation.
Okay. This was a paper by Ralph Lorenz, I think it was 2 years or 1 year ago. So in order to explain non-synchronous rotation, I mean, Titan is locked with Saturn. You know, it rotates in about 16 days, and it's like the moon around the Earth. We always see the same phase of the moon. So it's locked into its rotation around Saturn. But you can, if you have non-synchronous rotation, it's because you have some transfer of angular momentum between the atmosphere and the solid body. If Titan is completely frozen, is completely solid, if there is no liquid layers, then the inertia of the body is such that the change in the spin rate would be very, very small and couldn't be measured. If you have an ocean, then the crust is decoupled from the interior, and actually the transfer of angular momentum happens between the atmosphere and just the crust, Titan's crust. And it's much less mass, much less inertia, and then you can get values which can be measured by the apparent mislocation of geological features on Titan. So, you know, it was a very nice explanation of non-synchronous rotation. Actually, that's something we know for the Earth. We know that on Earth there is some transfer of angular momentum between the atmosphere and the solid Earth, and this has been measured. And this may, for example, explain the Chandler wobble that we observe, you know, the variations in the polar axis of the Earth. So for Titan, it was a very nice explanation, but apparently a bug existed in the process, and so they revised the values, and now the value that they have for the mislocation of the geological features is much smaller than the value they had before. I mean, it's a factor of 30 smaller. So it's so close to synchronous rotation that we cannot say that there is a non-synchronous rotation. It's within the error bars. But if we have synchronous rotation, it doesn't mean that there is no ocean. I mean, we have to be very careful. Non-synchronous rotation was easily explained by the presence of an ocean, but if we have, we can have a synchronous rotation and an ocean.
So it was just a processing error or
processing error.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting.
And actually, the paper came out in the same journal. You know, the paper by Brian Stinnes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just published a few months ago for the revised paper, saying that they had a problem, and so he has the new values for the rotation period. By the way, that reminds me that we have to go back to, you know, the kernels we are using for Cassini. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just found out that now they are not taking into account the precession of Saturn's orbit into the zero projection. If we keep doing that, we are going to get into trouble for the projections we need not for the radar, because they don't need that, but for ISS and VIMS observations.
Oh, dear. So Christoph is referring to the trajectory files that come out that scientists use to analyze their data. So needs to take all these things into account.
Yes.
Christoph, can you say anything more about the Huygens measurement of the that it indicated there was a conducting layer at 45 kilometers? Was that Schumann resonance or something?
Yes, exactly. That's the Schumann resonance.
Do you know anything about that? I know that's not particularly your area, but...
Well, actually, I just published a paper.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay. I didn't realize.
No, well, I just got the proof this morning.
Oh, excellent.
Well, actually, I work with because I was not involved against, but so I work with the people in France who have observed the decrease of the electric field. So what they observed is that at 36 Hertz, the horizontal component of the electric field decreased when Huygens got closer to the surface. So you have a kind of linear trend from about 100 kilometers altitude down to the surface. And at the surface, the value is not zero. And so they tried to understand why there is this electric field. And one way to explain that, so now I'm going to explain the Schumann resonance on Earth. On Earth, we have lightning, so we have electric signals. And these electric signals, because there are so many lightning on Earth, actually this electric signal create a magnetic wave which is stable around the Earth. And you have so a magnetic signal, which is called the Schumann resonance, which is stable and can be measured on Earth. So this is very well known. So on Earth, electric... So you can see that the lightning on Earth is vertical. So you have a kind of vertical component of the electric field, which produces a magnetic component. On Titan, because of Titan's eccentricity, the Saturn's magnetic field varies with time. So Titan experiences different values of the magnetic field. So you have variations in the magnetic field. So these variations of the magnetic field are going to create an electric signal. And so you create a wave, and it turns out that the 36 Hertz is exactly the frequency at which you expect this wave. And so this wave would be stable. So it's a kind of Schumann resonance, except that on Earth, the Schumann resonance is created by the electric signal, and on Titan, the Schumann resonance would be created by the magnetic signal. In order to get a Schumann resonance, you need to have two conductors. You need to have a cavity, and the cavity is bounded by two conductors. One conductor is the ionosphere, that's the upper conductor, and the lower conductor on Earth is the Earth's surface, mainly actually the ocean. And on Titan, the ice is not conductive. I mean, the conductive value for the ice is very low. It's not conductive at all. When you extrapolate the value, it has to get to zero where you have the conductive layer. And when you extrapolate the measurements which have been observed by Huygens, you find out that it gets to zero at 45 kilometer depth. So it means that the conductive layer would be at 45 kilometer depth, plus or minus 15 kilometers. And this conductive layer could be the ocean. I mean, the ocean is a good conductive layer.
That's a great explanation. I've never really fully understood that. So that was measured with what instrument on Huygens?
Oh, it was measured by the PW... let me go back to the slide.
It's the permittivity wave and altimetry analyzer, PWA, isn't that it?
Exactly. Oh. It was a part of the Huygens atmospheric structure instrument.
Oh, okay. All right. That's excellent. Very good. Interesting.
And actually, we measure not only the electric field, but also the conductivity, and the model that has been developed by Christian Béguin, who is in Orléans. And actually, I'm going to Orléans next week to work with him more on that topic. So the model he has developed takes into account the conductivity values that were measured by Huygens probe at the same time.
That's great. Thank you. Any other questions for Christoph? Well, it sounds like maybe not, so I think that wraps it up. Thank you very much, Christoph. It was very interesting.
Welcome, and I was a little bit too long. Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. An hour and a half is great, and that's about what we hit, so that's wonderful. So thank you very much. I know it's a lot of work to put these talks together, but now you're set. You can go out and give it, many times. So we really appreciate it. So we've had a couple of Charm Telecons on Titan last month and this month, and next month we're going to change topics. I think we have Carl Murray talking about Saturn's rings. I think he's going to talk about some recent work on the F ring. So that'll be kind of a change of pace. So I have to confirm that, but I think he's on for next month. So again, thank you to our speaker. And anybody have any comments out there?
Just one.
I think it was fantastic.
Good. Go ahead. I think that was Lynn.
Oh, no, that was Gordon Houston, Solar System Ambassador in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
You said the F-ring. Who's doing the F-ring again?
It's Carl Murray of Queen Mary College in London.
Oh, okay.
I thought I heard a woman's voice out there.
Yes, it's Janet Howard in Memphis. I just wanted to say thank you to Christoph. I really enjoyed it. I had to really listen, but I enjoyed it, and I'm going to spend a little more time researching some of the things that he brought up. So thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. And if you have any comments, please send them to me. I can improve my presentation.
Oh, that's nice, Christoph. If you don't have Christoph's address, just send your comments to me, and I'll forward them on to him. That would be fine, too.
Sure.
That's nice to hear. Positive feedback. Any other comments out there? Okay, so thank you very much, and we'll talk to you all next month.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.